Good afternoon, and thank you for tuning in to Faith and Reason here on Holy Family Radio, Grand Rapids, Kalamazoo. I'm your host, Dr. John Pinero, and for the next hour today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Jared Ortiz, professor, assistant professor of religion at Hope College in Holland, Michigan. I've wanted to have Jared on the show for some time now. I met him last year, and he's one of a small number of Catholic scholars working in the region of West Michigan, and I think he's somebody that our listeners, you should be familiar with, and the kinds of things he's trying to accomplish here locally, and the scholarship he's engaged in. In fact, we're going to have Jared at Aquinas College, by the time this show runs, we've already had him at Aquinas College in late March at our Catholic Studies Colloquium there, and we hope to have him back after that. Jared earned his PhD in historical theology at the Catholic University of America in 2012, so very recently, where he worked on St. Augustine, and I think we'll be talking about Augustine a bit today as well. His major area was early Christian studies, so one of the things he does at Hope is patristics. Is that right, Ed? Now, while he's at Hope College now, he's also affiliated with the Augustine Institute in Denver, Colorado, and I know some of my students from Aquinas College are very interested in the Augustine Institute and have since enrolled there. Jared has written several articles on the early church fathers and on the concept of deification, something we'll be talking about much later in the program today. And that's really his research agenda, understanding deification in the writings of the early church fathers, the Latin patristic fathers, especially as it's rooted in the theology of creation and as we see it in the liturgy. Jared also was instrumental in writing up the curriculum for St. Jerome Academy, something that has since proved a model for other academies around the country. Welcome to the program, Jared.
Thank you very much, John.
I would like to start out by saying that there's so many religious colleges in the United States, as you know, small, large, universities, small liberal arts colleges. It's something that really doesn't exist in most other countries, particularly in Europe. This small liberal arts college phenomenon associated with denominations and churches. And I teach at one of these schools. I teach at Aquinas College. You teach at Hope College. And Aquinas College lays claim to being a Catholic college. It's not the Franciscan University of Steubenville, but it's also not been run out of the diocese by the bishop either. And we've been engaged in a Catholic renewal there for about a good 10 years now, and a lot of good things happening, as I hope our listeners know. And so I'm wondering what it's like then to be a Catholic at Hope College, which is associated with the Reformed Church of America. And maybe some of our listeners might not know the difference between the Reformed Church of America and the Christian Reformed Church. Maybe you could help us out there too. But let's just start out with a little biography, a kind of life at Hope College as a Catholic. You were hired there as the sole Catholic in their religion department as a religion professor.
That's right. Yeah, so Hope is, as you said, associated with the Reformed Church of America, which is a Protestant denomination sort of in the tradition of Calvin, John Calvin, as in this Calvinist strain. And Hope's just, it really is a fascinating place. It describes itself as ecumenical in character and rooted in the Reformed tradition. And I think that's a very, very good description. And Hope, like many colleges, and especially many Catholic colleges, in the 60s and 70s had a kind of identity crisis. And, you know, we're sort of very traditional Reformed Protestants up until that time. And like many Catholic colleges, kind of abandoned their identity for a period. But they decided to lay claim to it again, you know, and to turn it around, and actually have been undergoing a renewal for some time, trying to sort of reshape themselves.
When did that start? Did that start under Rich Ray, your current provost? Is that an older movement than that?
It does precede the current provost, but probably, I mean, it certainly preceded my time there, but probably sometime in the 90s, there was sort of a deliberate move to say, you know what, we're a Christian college. We don't want to let this go. Mm-hmm. We don't want to go the way of, say, Kalamazoo College, which also used to be a Christian college and seems to be no longer identified in any discernible way. So this renewal has been going on, but it's very interesting. They've always had some kind of ecumenical sense, let's say, amongst different Protestant groups that have been going to that school. But in this period where they sort of were questioning their identity, all of these Catholics kind of slipped in. All these Catholics were hired because there wasn't any sort of clear hiring policies. And then Catholic students started coming. And then so when they decided to embrace their Christian identity again, they sort of said, hey, well, we have this Catholic population here, and we have all these diverse Protestant groups here, and this is perhaps the way forward. And so they sort of define themselves, you know, not as, say, a Wheaton or a Calvin, you know, Calvin sort of very rooted in the Christian Reformed tradition, or a Wheaton, a very kind of evangelical Protestant school, but said, you know, we're going to do this ecumenical thing and try to be vibrantly Christian, but open to a variety of Christian expressions.
I mean, Aquinas College included is open to other Christians. I think a little over half of our student body would, on their entrance survey, mark that they're Catholic, and that could mean various things, of course, in terms of practicing the faith. And we do have, I'm not sure on the percentage among the professors. I do know, however, that we have some Protestant faculty who are very much in favor of the mission, and certainly a large enough number of Protestant students to there's a very popular club on campus that gathers just for praise and worship music of the kind you'd see at an evangelical church for maybe a half hour before the sermon, and they're singing what sounds to me like rock and roll songs, and I don't think I could do that every Sunday, but God bless them because they like and appreciate it, and I think that's that's a good approach in the sense that you can also teach a lot about your church if you're open to people. If it's a gift, right, you want to give it away. You don't want to keep them from coming. But when they get there, you want them to experience your faith in its fullness, which is something we're working on at Aquinas, right? You want them to leave and say, so that's what a Catholic college is, right, is like. And I wonder and hope then, are they, and maybe you can't say this, I know you're an assistant professor, that means you don't have tenure, so we'll be really careful today. But are they going about ecumenism and you would think the right way from their perspective, that is honest, open, not watering themselves down, but just accepting you? How do you read that?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, and it's actually a very live question at Hope. I mean, when I was being interviewed for this position, so it's a position teaching Catholic studies in the religion department, when it was my turn to ask the questions, I said, well, why would a Protestant school have a position in Catholic studies? And the answer that came back, I thought, was very beautiful. And they said, look, we want someone who stands for the continuity of the whole tradition. And we want that for our Catholic students, and we want that for our Protestant students. And I thought that that was very beautiful. That was very comforting. And when I got the job, I remember we were talking about teaching various classes. And I said, well, you know, when I teach this church history class, I could put things in sort of more broadly ecumenical terms and not make it so distinctively Catholic. And they said, no. We hired you as a Catholic. Teach as a Catholic. Mm-hmm. They said, you know, you don't have to, you know, carry the Catholic flag. You don't have to defend everything that comes out of the church. You know, we don't expect you to be the representative of the whole Catholic Church.
What do Catholics think about that?
Right.
There you go. All billion of them, right?
Exactly. Yeah. But they said, look, you're a Catholic, teach as a Catholic, and that's good for our students.
That's very appropriate. I for penance, apparently, at their church, Ivanrest Community Church, which is a Christian Reformed church, and invited me to do two adult education classes in a row on the Catholic Church. It's history and then a Q&A. Uh-huh. And I was telling them that I guess this is for penance because it was during the first couple of weeks of Lent. And I said, well, thank you. But I told them that as well. And it's something that I heard Jim Caviezel say here in Grand Rapids when he spoke at a pro-life dinner several years ago. And which is, you know, it's not an all-Catholic audience, right? It's the annual pro-life dinner and fundraiser. And he said, I can't talk as anything but a Catholic. So when I talk about history and I talk about these issues, I'm not trying to offend you. I'm not trying to step on toes or purposely hit hot-button issues. But there's no other way for me to say these things. And it is a beautiful thing that you would go to Hope College and they would say, that's how we want you to teach, right? You don't have to have tiptoe through the tulips on some of these things. I didn't even mean to make a Calvinist pun when I did that. that was great. Just through the tulip. But
no, it's true. And actually, I find everyone is so responsive. I mean, part of that is just, you know, perhaps just West Michigan nice, but that's not a bad thing. But, you know, all the faculty, all the staff have been so welcoming and so encouraging. But I've just found the response amongst the students to just be remarkable, both Protestant and Catholic students. And so, I mean, I teach a church history class. I teach a early Christian class called The Mystery of the Incarnation, a Christology class. I taught a class on patristics in general. And now I'm teaching a class on Catholic Christianity. And in all of those classes, and especially the church history class, you know, these students come, and if you're coming to Hope, you know, the sort of typical profile of a Hope student is sort of generally pious, good student, intelligent, thoughtful, sweet. I mean, you have your range, you have your agnostics and your atheists, you have your lapsed Catholics and your bitter Protestants. But for the most part, I mean, that's just kind of the ethos there is just kind of a general piety and eagerness. And I teach these things to them, and they're so receptive, you know, and it's so encouraging. And we teach them these things, and I teach this church history class, which I call From the Annunciation to the Reformation. So we start with the angel coming to Mary. We start with the Incarnation. Mary is the first disciple, and then we go up to the Reformation. We talk about the divisions in the church, which we all live in. And I tell them, I said, look, everything we learn in this class is common history. Everything we learn is your patrimony. I said, you know, if you're Catholic, a lot of this might sound familiar. We're going to be talking about bishops and popes and all that stuff. I said, but look, if you're Protestant, this is your history too. These are your ancestors. These are your popes. These are your bishops, the good ones and the bad ones. You know, I said, but these are also your saints. So, you know, this is also your monasticism. You know, and I find many of them really, really respond to that. You know, they end up falling in love with Saint Benedict or Saint Francis. Actually, the most popular book, I give a survey, just a quick evaluation of the books that we read at the end of the semester and say, which ones did you like? Which ones were too hard? Which ones were this? Several classes in a row for now 2 years. I've taught this church history class probably 7 or 8 times. Every single time, Thomas Aquinas is the favorite book that we read in the church history class.
Now, when you say read Thomas Aquinas, the book, are they reading Thomas?
Yeah,
are they reading Thomas, or are they reading biography? Or
no, we're reading selections. So Peter Kreft has a very nice book called The Shorter Summa.
Yeah, no, I have it. That's a book for somebody like me, so it's good. I thought I had it. It was like a Summa of the Summa, and then there was an even shorter version of that or something. It kept getting shorter. And
yes, they read the short one.
That's a great one.
And we read the proofs.
It's got kind of the key one, yeah. the key.
And happiness. Yeah, and they love it. And you think, well, these are Protestant kids. They're not going to like Thomas. And Thomas seems very dry and too precise and so philosophical. They just fall in love with his clarity and his wisdom. And they say, this just resonates with my life. And time and again, that's the favorite book. And then usually the second favorite book is Augustine, City of God.
So is there an element of evangelization then? I guess in every classroom at a Christian college, there's some element of evangelization. And I'm wondering how do you, in terms of ethics or expectations or parents' expectations who send their children to Hope, how do you avoid what pejoratively would be called proselytization as opposed to evangelization? And maybe that's in the eye of the beholder, but I, you know, we're told that, and we tell, and we mean it at Aquinas, that we don't evangelize outright, but on the other hand, we also answer questions sincerely And I'll give my opinion in the classroom any time. If a student says, why do you find this compelling and not that compelling? And you tell them, you're a professor. But I'm wondering what that would be like at a college where some parents have they've sent their children to this college who are adults, but they're their children. You're acting as the parent there, and their kids come out to, they go in RCA and come out Catholic, and it's at Professor Ortiz's fault for showing them the way of the church fathers. And I say that because I was a lapsed Catholic when I went into college, and I took a New Testament class, and I took an early Christian thought class, and the church fathers just grabbed me, and then Merton grabbed me, and that was it. You know, the rest was history after that, and I think it was finding that deep intellectual tradition that I didn't know existed that made me see the church in a whole new light beyond I grew up in a parish with padded pews and a risen Christ on the wall. We'll just stop there, right? But I just, you know, I didn't know there was that depth to the faith before until I was at a secular California State University with an Episcopal priest as a teacher talking about the church fathers. And I don't know how you would address that or if
if the students are converting in mass, then perhaps we'll have to have another conversation. But I begin and end all of my classes with prayer. And one of the things I say is, look, this is a theology class. And in a theology class, we're learning about God. And if it's church history, we're learning about how God works in history. If it's Christology, it's, you know, how God has revealed himself in Jesus Christ. And I said, because this is a theology class and it's about God, if we want to know about God, it's important not to just talk about him, but to talk to him. And so we begin and end every class with prayer. And then I say this on the first day. I said, well, look, I said, and if you're not comfortable praying, that's fine. And I said, if you're not a believer, I said, that's fine. I said, I ask that you respect that this is what Christians do. And I encourage you to be a good cultural anthropologist and observe Christians in their native habitat. Right. And I have to say, I've had a number of agnostic students go through my classes, and
do they sit in the corner like Jane Goodall writing about that? I'm going to name this one.
Yes, gorillas in the mist, indeed, Christians in the mist. But no, the agnostics tell me that they are so grateful for that sort of thing. It gives them a ton of freedom. But because the Protestants are so, most of the Protestant students who come here are so pious. And they just have this piety. They bring this piety. They're so grateful when someone prays, and they're so grateful that they take God seriously, and they're so grateful when they see faith and learning come together, that I've had no complaints about that sort of thing from...
Would most professors pray in class at Hope? Or
no, probably not. I mean, okay. Probably only a handful do.
Okay. That would be the same at Aquinas. I know, I mean... The nuns that I know, most of them are not teaching now. When I first started, they would pray in class, a few of them, but very rarely would class open up with a prayer. Maybe around final exam time, there starts to be an urge on the part of the students to pray the famous student prayer of Thomas Aquinas. But
one of the things that Hope is very beautiful about, one of the things they take they're trying to take very, very seriously, is this connection between faith and learning. And so we have workshops on it, and we try to initiate the new teachers into this, and you know, to greater or lesser degrees of success, I think. But it's something they take seriously, and they want to say, look, you can be a Christian scholar. And they want to teach the students that these things don't have to be divorced aspects of their life. And, you know, at some point in the semester, I talked to the students about, you know, that, you know, Paul says to pray without ceasing. Well, if that meant verbal or mental prayer, we'd all collapse after about an hour. Because we're spiritually out of shape. But what he means is to turn our whole life into a prayer. And so that means offering up everything we do, making it a sacrifice to God. And so I say, look, that's what this class is. That's why we pray in class, so it can be offered up to God for his glory. I said, when you do your work, I said, turn your desk into an altar and make your work a sacrifice, an acceptable sacrifice to him. And so, you know, I mean, and I, when I pray, I mean, just this goes to the proselytizing question, is that, you know, I always pray in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and I cross myself. And that's a great comfort to the Catholic students who don't see that on campus, you know, and so it's a great comfort to them. And it's a way of also teaching the Protestant students that, look, this is the way that most Christians have prayed for most of the time, you know, and you don't do that, that's fine, and you don't have to do that. But I think they appreciate it.
Great. I was at Ivan Rest. I was the only one crossing myself. They were doing prayers in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. This is what we do, right?
Habituated, you know, yes,
and,
I know.
And, I remember when my wife and I were going through, we were being taught a marriage class, and she was not Catholic at the time. And, in fact, at first we were not married in the Catholic Church, so that we rectified that soon after. But the Episcopal priest, this professor, who turned out to be kind of a mentor. In fact, it was Father Tim Vivian who's written extensively on the Coptics and translates Coptic works of the Desert Fathers. I don't know if you've ever come across him. But anyhow, he said he was explaining what the ceremony would be like, and he was going to do the sign of the cross. And I remember a guy said, whoa, 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 wait a minute. That sounds like a really Catholic prayer. And he just said, It's the cross. It's really old Christian prayer, and I'm not Catholic. Although he would have thought of himself as Catholic with a small C, this man. But it's amazing those things that we think we've hung on to them as Catholics. We've preserved them, but they don't have to be so distinctively Catholic that somehow a Protestant needs to run away from them in order to maintain their identity.
No, it's actually very interesting when we got to St. Francis last year. A number of my students fell in love with St. Francis, and I was talking about the First Order of Franciscans, that's the brothers, and the Second Order, which is the women Franciscans, then the Third Order, that's the lay order. And I was explaining why Francis did this, established this in the Middle Ages, and one of my students said, well, are there still Third Order Franciscans? And I said, yes. And they said, how do you become one? And I, explained this. And I said, you know, the closest Franciscan to us lives in Holland, and he is a Lutheran. So he's a Third Order Franciscan. He even wears a habit. He's been to Hope. And like, oh, really? Protestants can be Franciscans? And I said, sure. You know, I said, look, this is your tradition. You know, I said, you need to reclaim it. This is one of the casualties of the Reformation, especially this monastic tradition is something, unfortunately, Protestants have been separated from. And they're recently rediscovering it. There's this whole new monasticism movement that Protestants are embracing. This monastic ideal, which is wonderful. I mean, I think it just points us again towards a deeper unity. But I said, look, this is just one of the casualties of the Reformation, is that you guys have never heard of this stuff. You know?
I think that's one way the church reunifies. It's a little bit what they've tried to do in Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, the island of Ireland, some would call it. Got to cover all the bases with that topic. But on the island, when it comes to after the Good Friday Accords, the thinking was, instead of trying to unify the country in blood, right?
Yes.
Unify it by start making, as Jerry Adams would say, the borders just start disappearing. Mm-hmm. So you start sharing passports. You start with a number of things that you simply have in common across the border, and you remove some of the checkpoints, and you don't really know when you're passing now from Ireland into Northern Ireland, unless you immediately pass into a city and there's big British flags, and it's kind of obvious where you're at, depending on whether it's a Catholic town or a Protestant town. But in general, I could really feel that the last time I was there. That is unification simply through evolution and not through politicians getting together and say, okay, now we're unified, and you're going to raise a different flag or something. And it sounds like what you're talking about is a little bit like that. So you just say, look, this is your church too. Let's look at this pre-Reformation church. But aren't there going to be saints and even those among the fathers and perhaps those among the iconoclasts who Protestants might look back and say, here was somebody who said what we're saying now, and they were vilified at the time. I mean, won't some Protestants look back at certain individuals that Catholics would always consider heretics and say, no, that was the real church trying to pop up and then being smacked down by Rome and then trying to pop up. And then I think that's got to be the case with some of that pre-Reformation history, because they don't believe, as Mormons do, that the church somehow disappeared for 1,200 years after Constantine legalized it, right? And then just kind of, you know, it popped up somewhere else and was hidden and completely awry for all those years.
Right. Well, I mean, I think probably most of the students have no historical sensibility at all.
Your student? Really?
Yes.
Because our students come in with a massive, massive historical sensibility. I'm shocked.
You must get better students out of this. No, I think, you know, a sort of default young Protestant position is that they've never thought about these things, and they have the Bible and they have their church, and the whole history of it is not something they've ever thought about. And so when they learn about it, they're often very, very grateful. I mean, just in terms of this advancing the ecumenical conversation, I think it advances in stages and in different ways in different people. I remember one student, CRC his whole life, grew up in Holland, wants to go. He's studying Dutch and, you know, wants to study there overseas. And, you know, about 4 or 5 weeks into the church history class, we walked out together and he said, you know, I didn't want to take this class. I said, okay. And he said, but my advisor made me. I said, okay. And he said, and I'm glad I'm taking it. I said, why? I said, well, because I used to think that Catholics were really spooky and superstitious. And, and I laughed. And, he said, and now I see that, there's reasons for why you guys do things. He said, I still think you're wrong, but
that's an important step, though.
It's huge.
It really is. This Ivan Rest deal I mentioned with me was that's what I told him. The point is, like, I mean, granted, you never want to be in a church if you don't believe what it teaches is true. That's right. The end game, right? So we're all after truth. In that sense, so this is what you should always be thinking. Always be genuinely searching for the truth wherever it's found. And so I'm, you know, it's good to hear that from students that at least they will find out that we're not, we hope, all of us, some of us maybe, on a given day, spooky and superstitious, but we're not supposed to be, right? We're not supposed to be. Now, we should take some time here to identify the program. This is Dr. John Pinero. You're listening to Faith and Reason on Holy Family Radio. I'm interviewing Dr. Jared Ortiz, Assistant Professor of Religion at Hope College, and one of the Catholic professors at that college, and the Professor of Catholic Studies in the Religion Department. I'd like to switch gears only a bit here.
Please.
And talk about this project you're working on in Hope. So you have this number of Catholic students there and some Catholic faculty, and you've described the ecumenical nature of your school. And I know what your provost, Rich Ray, commonly calls a historic Christian church, and he's got a variety of terms to try to encompass Christians from different traditions. So you would like to start something you call the St. Benedict Institute for Catholic Thought, Culture, and Evangelization. And you and I have talked about this before, and I was of two minds when you first introduced it to me. I thought, well, that sounds like competition for Catholic studies, but it sounds really good for the church. So what's a good Catholic boy to do, right? I'll support it and see what we can do. And we are cooperating to bring Joseph Pierce to Grand Rapids and to Holland in September of 2014. So that will be Pierce hasn't been in town for quite a few years. He came to a Chesterton Institute dinner here, in 2004 or 5. And my wife has interesting memories of it because she was in the car with Pierce when the driver didn't know where he was going and went the wrong way on a one-way street downtown trying to find Bistro Bella Vita. And we just told him, don't worry, that's how we drive in America. It's not a problem. And but it was a good time. It was a fun time. It would be great to have him back. But enough on Pierce for a moment. But I just wanted to say I think I would support. I think it's a great thing what you're doing out there, even though, I mean, my personal goal would be to have all the Catholic students go to Aquinas. Yes. To renew the Catholicity there, but then it sounds like, wow, they're really, there's a purpose for what's going on there, as well as at Aquinas, at Hope College, I mean. Mm-hmm. So I think this sounds like a great thing you're working on. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the plans and where they are now, and give us your give us your pitch.
Sure. So I'll just give you a little bit of background on how this came about. So, I mean, I got to Hope a year and a half ago, and again, to teach Catholic studies, and I just have a solicitude for the Catholic students, and about 20% of the student body is Catholic, so that's about almost 600 students at Hope. And on our informal estimates, probably 90% of them are not going to Mass.
90%?
That would be
a
rough estimate. Yeah, we could even say 80% if we want to be generous. Perhaps they're going home or going to different masses or a different parish or something like that. But that seems to be about the case, 80 to 90% of the students. And those numbers are not terribly shocking compared to the national numbers. If you read like Christian Smith, the great Notre Dame sociologist of young Christianity, he studies faith patterns amongst young people. So I don't think those numbers are terribly shocking. I mean, they are shocking. But
well, I mean, it sounds like your Protestant students are pious, and they're probably going to church, and your Catholic students are have some level of piety, maybe, but they're not attending Mass.
Right. And so, I mean, at Hope, it probably is a little bit more of a shocking number because there is such a piety at Hope. So, for example, they have what's called chapel three times a week. It's a 20-minute service for a daily Mass, sort of, but they have 10 minutes of Christian rock and roll and 10 minutes of sermon, biblical lesson. And I spoke there last semester, and they have
chapel. So faculty speak at this?
And they have four chaplains who are great chaplains, and it's always just it's a great thing. It's totally voluntary, and probably 800 students attend that three times a week.
Wow!
And then they have an ecumenical service on Sunday, and probably about 1,400 students attend that. That's almost half the college.
That's good.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
I think. And so with that level of piety, you'd think that the Catholics would be more engaged. But when they come to Hope, and I think one of two things happens, either they get swept up in this very dynamic Protestant ministry, which again is very wholesome, and I encourage all my Catholic students to attend it, because great lessons, great preaching. I don't like the music, but they love it. but it's very wholesome, and they learn a ton. And I encourage them to do it. Either they get swept up into that and they abandon the faith, or they and similarly they'll meet very dynamic evangelical friends, you know, who will challenge them and persuade them and bring them off to a local Protestant community. Or they come to Hope and they say, this whole evangelical thing is not for me. It's weird. And the Catholic thing is boring, and I'm not going to do anything. So they drift away.
Is there only option a couple those two parishes out in Holland? Is
there that are two parishes, yeah. So one on the north side, about 5 miles.
So there's no
away.
Newman Club or priest who visits campus right now to say Mass, anything like that?
Yeah, so the local parish is about half a mile, three quarters of a mile away, which seems like an eternity to most students.
But they're not going to walk that, probably.
No, I mean, there's a course, a group of students who go there every Sunday.
Yeah.
It's not a big deal to walk it. but that the priest from there and the priest from the north side will come to campus once a month to say on campus Mass. But there's no visible Catholic presence, and that's part of the problem. And you know, I had student after student take my church history class, Catholic student, come to faith just by being in the class, just by learning about the faith, and they come to me in office hours finally and say, you know, I haven't gone to church in 3 years or since my confirmation. And now I'm reading this stuff, and I just think the Catholic Church is so beautiful. I don't know why anyone didn't tell me this before.
This is my own story here.
It's my story, too.
Oh, is it?
I came back to the faith in college as well. So, I mean, I have a heart for these kids who have a really terrible Catholic education. Either they go through Catholic school, and they're inoculated to the faith, or they go to public school, and they have CCD, which is even worse. And then they get to college, and they're just blown by the winds. If they get caught up in secular winds, they go that way, or Protestant winds, they go that way. And so just kind of student after student saying, you know, I didn't even know there was a Catholic church a half a mile away. You know, I didn't know there was a union of Catholic students. We have a very dynamic Catholic student group small but powerful, does a lot of great stuff. So just seeing this, I said, you know, I and a couple of other Catholic faculty said, you know, we need to do something for these students. What we need to do is to make the Catholic presence more visible. We need to institutionalize it. And so we said, well, how could we do this? And so we talked about doing some programs, bringing in speakers, doing some ecumenical dialogue, an immersion trip, you know. So we started talking about all these different programs that we could do. And these kind of eventually coalesced under this idea of having an institute that would have both an intellectual component and a spiritual component. And so, you know, we worked on this, and I'd like to read the mission statement, which I think captures it really nicely, what we're trying to do. It says, the St. Benedict Institute seeks to promote and nurture intellectual work done from the heart of the Catholic Church, to foster an ecumenical community of Catholic Christians and friends committed to the renewal of culture, and to aid in the formation of intellectually and spiritually mature Christians by making available the riches of the Catholic tradition to Hope College and the wider community. So that's kind of the vision, is to say, look, these kids, they live in a very toxic culture. You know, America has generally become a pretty toxic culture, full of relativism, full of temptation, and full of really sort of pernicious ideas that kind of drag kids into really bad ways of thinking and then bad ways of acting. And so we wanted something that, on the one hand, had real serious intellectual chops, things that could educate students, form them intellectually, inspire them, show them the life of the Catholic mind, show them the great Catholic intellectual tradition, to say, look, this is a coherent and compelling way of understanding the world, right? So that on the one hand, and then also to attend to their spiritual needs and say, look, worship with your Protestant brothers and sisters, amen, you know, do that, please, but don't abandon the Catholic faith, you know. And so to have a dynamic Catholic ministry to form these students in a Catholic way so that we can actually be truly ecumenical, so that we don't just merge into a kind of lowest common denominator, mm-hmm. Ecumenism or Christianity.
The cafeteria ecumenism kind of.
Yes.
Yeah.
But that we could come from a place of integrity. You know, we could say, look, we're Catholic. This is what Catholics believe. This is how Catholics worship. We want to share our riches with you, and we want you to share your riches with us.
Well, what I admire about what you're doing is I think this is the necessary work right now in the church generally. It's really the goal of the Faith and Reason program, that is to make the riches of the intellectual tradition available, because I think there's many Catholics who don't know the depth and breadth of their church in terms of its intellectual tradition. They might in their homes follow a certain tradition or devotions, and they don't really know what those are connected to or when they start. And maybe they do. I find, you know, it's not that the faithful and the lay faithful aren't educated, but it's not all of us have time to sit around and read the Church Fathers and Thomas Aquinas and study these things in depth. And yet, this is what shapes the faith and the liturgy and the words of the liturgy, and, you know, tracing back to see who wrote what Eucharistic prayer going back into the early church, right. And there's some that were written later, and you can tell some would say, but to get Catholics to know that, but also to get other Christians to be aware of that as well, like you said, that it's not superstition and spookiness, that there's actually real depth there, right. And particularly in an area like this with the Calvinistic Reformed churches, their love of Augustine is something that we ought to have in common, and we read Augustine a little bit differently, right. On some things, but they, you know, Augustine's very big and important in their tradition, right. And certain liturgical sensibilities, I think, as well. So I think it's the necessary thing. Your second goal there among your three goals the third renewal of culture.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to think, you know, politics was the answer, and it didn't take long to be disabused of that. It's really all about culture. So right. If there's in a general way to renew the culture, and culture comes from religion, then you've got to do the intellectual heavy work, right?
Right.
Because the religion is going to create a culture, but a culture doesn't create a religion.
Right.
And T.S. Eliot and some other earlier 20th century folks already thought we were floating on the fumes of Christian civilization then, and we're getting nearly 100 years later.
Right.
So what are we floating on now? it's really good work you're doing.
Right. Yeah, and there very much is an Augustinian and sort of Christopher Dawson understanding, you know, sort of driving that, especially that point, you know, cult is the heart of culture, religion is the heart of culture. And at Hope, I mean, there really is kind of one cult, and it's in some ways that's what makes it such a vibrant and dynamic place, but it also makes ecumenical dialogue hard, because there is this kind of one ecumenical worship service, which is kind of a blend of things, and there is no other kind of visible cult.
And it's a real fear. So you go there and you feel moved by the Spirit, and people are talking about Jesus, and you're a lapsed Catholic, and what would stop you as a young person from thinking, I guess, why isn't this good enough?
Right.
And I could I go read something on the side, or maybe I'll go to Mass at Easter to stay in touch with my roots or something, and be a CNE Christmas Easter Catholic, but why not have more? And evangelical churches are really, you know, really good at that.
They are.
They're really good at being attractive on that particular level. So you're going to inject something deeper here, it looks like. So what kind of programs do you hope to offer through this St. Benedict Institute?
Well, we actually had our first event just recently. Eduardo Echevarria came and spoke on Catholic and Reformed ecumenism. And that was a wonderful event. He gave a talk. It was open to the public.
Was that the one with the boundaries, basis? It was three Bs, I remember.
Basis, boundaries, and benefits.
Yes.
So that was good. And he talked about some of the history of sort of Catholic Reformed exchanges and attitudes of Protestants towards Catholics, and sort of what advances ecumenism and what doesn't. And that was open to the public. We had a lot of students there. We had a lot of faculty there. And then a smaller group of faculty met and had dinner with Eduardo to continue the conversation in a more intimate way. And leading up to that, we actually had a series of lunches and reading groups to sort of prepare for his visit. And so, you know, we as a burgeoning institute organized all of this. And it was interesting. One of the comments that came out by the chair of the religion department said, you know, we've been coexisting ecumenically for many years now, but we've never actually had ecumenical dialogue. And so it's a real desire of Hope College to have this serious ecumenical dialogue, and there's a lot of wonderful partners there. And we share a campus with Western Theological Seminary, which is a Reformed seminary. And so we have just wonderful resources there for ecumenical dialogue, but it just hasn't gotten off the ground, but now there's a real momentum to get it off the ground. So we'd like to be a part of that. So because also, you know, this is sort of, you know, Reformed headquarters of the world, the RCA and CRC here. But Holland is also positioned between Chicago, South Bend, and Detroit, which has really remarkable resources for Catholic things, you know, Mundelein and University of Chicago and Loyola and Notre Dame and Sacred Heart Seminary. And so we actually can engage in pretty interesting and pretty serious dialogue.
I mean, Aquinas has done that as well. We keep bringing over Sacred Heart faculty, and we had Cardinal George here a while ago from Chicago, and Duncan Stroik, and some others coming up next year whom I can't name yet from Notre Dame. They're going to be brought up not by Catholic Studies, but actually by our philosophy department, and our new philosopher bringing up some folks he knows from his time at Notre Dame. And we are positioned really well. I mean, there's such a neat area here in West Michigan with all these religious colleges. Right. I mean, I can say quite literally and honestly that my career would not be where it is without Calvin College. Some of the seminars there I've attended over the summer were instrumental in getting my new book off the ground and off to a publisher and published. I mean, that's what did it. And so I'm, you know, kind of thankful when I see us all cooperating in some way, particularly in the renewal of culture, which is something we all have in common, wanting a more Christian culture.
Right.
We can debate the definitions and the niceties and particularities, but we can certainly see that our culture is no longer Christian, broadly speaking, in the way it once was.
Yeah.
And so that there's things that no one would have even talked about in the open air even 30 years ago that would have seemed topsy-turvy or nuts. Right. And now we, you know, now we're the ones on the defense.
Right. Now this is the ecumenism of the trenches, you know. And, you know, it's not full unity, but it is a step towards unity, you know, that we do need to.
Well, look at, you know, at the Cairo conference, the Muslims in the Vatican got together and,
right.
and killed the pro-abortion, pro-contraception work of, I think it was Hillary Clinton was at the Cairo conference pushing that for the United States.
Right.
Was that in the 90s now?
Yeah.
Am I really? Well, you know, you get older and older. Things seem like they were yesterday, but strange bedfellows sometimes.
Right.
So you've already had your first event. Then what do you have coming up? What kinds of types of events? I'm sure you'll have the internal, very student-oriented events, scholarly events, speakers, that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. So our next event is Father Damien Ferenc is coming in April, and he's great priest out of the Diocese of Cleveland, and does a lot of writing, online blogs, and popular speaking. And he's going to come to Hope, and he's going to preach a mission. He's going to preach a Lenten mission. You know, and again, we did something similar to this last year, and we just had a wonderful turnout of Catholic students and who went to confession, and many of them for the first time in years.
Wow.
And a priest friend who
Great.
Came and did it last year said, "That's the most important work I've done this Lent, is that these 20 kids are now ready for Easter." You know,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, we had to wait, you know, we had adoration and mass, and then there was still a line for confession. And so he stayed an extra hour or so to get all those confessions. And so we're going to do something similar this year in terms of preaching a mission. You already mentioned Joseph Pierce, and we're Catholic Studies at Aquinas and the St. Benedict Forum are working together on that to bring Pierce here. And he's going to speak on the imagination in Lewis and Tocqueville, and he's also going to speak about his journey from neo-Nazism to Catholicism.
It's a shocking story. I heard him on, I think it was Marcus Grody's Journey Home program on EWTN a while back, talking about that. And I knew he had sort of that past, but I didn't know how deep and wide it was. It's really quite a Augustinian story of sorts.
Yes. No, and they love conversion stories over there. And, the Office of Multicultural Education is going to co-sponsor it with us, and English Department is going to co-sponsor it with us. And, I mean, that's just been the wonderful thing, is we have these ideas, and we just bring them to Hope, and people say, yeah, that's wonderful.
Broad support. I look over here on the list you've given me of the different departments and staff departments also participating in co-sponsorships, and then of course Catholic Studies outside of Hope, and what's the diocesan response been?
So far it's been wonderful. I mean, the institute is not a fully fledged institute yet. It's actually what we're calling the St. Benedict Forum, and at the moment it's being located at the local parish, just in terms of its tax and legal structure, and that just works very nicely because the parish and the college have what is called a covenant partnership. And this is the campus ministries at Hope College has reached out to some of the local churches to say, look, we'll give you special privileges and we'll make this partnership, this covenant partnership, that we both have the same solicitude for the students. So this is the Protestant campus ministry reaching out to the local Catholic church and saying, hey, how can we support you and how can you support us in helping these students? And so that relationship already exists, and it's a wonderful relationship. The local pastor, Catholic pastor there, and the dean of the chapel are good friends, and they get along very well. And actually, you know, just for example, the local priest does an ecumenical Ash Wednesday service at Hope College, at the chapel service every Ash Wednesday. And again, 800 kids.
Oh.
So he preaches the sermon on Ash Wednesday.
Isn't that amazing?
And they do
Ash Wednesday is one of those. It's really, I've watched even in my lifetime Lenten observance and Ash Wednesday in particular take off among non-Catholics in a way that it just didn't used to to be there.
It was very beautiful, and I was asked to help distribute ashes, and it was just wonderful. A lot of my students, a lot of my Protestant students from past semesters got in my line, you know. So that was very sweet, and it was just wonderful, and I think, you know, maybe before they wouldn't have done that, but this is just, again, something Hope's committed to, and it's very beautiful. So the St. Benedict Forum is in that structure, so we have that relationship. So that's where we are now, and we're working toward a more permanent institutional structure. The difficulty is, honestly, that there's no models for this, you know, that this has actually not been done before in this way. The big model for Catholic institutes is the Lumen Christi Institute, which is at the University of Chicago, not a part of it, but next to it. But that's an institute for Catholic thought, and so ours is going to combine an institute for Catholic thought with a kind of Newman Center model.
It's well, when I see the word evangelization in there, I get excited and impressed that it's more than just about thought. Right. Because the implication, as you were saying earlier, is that faith in learning, faith in study, as we would say at Aquinas with the Dominican charism, is study leading right. to contemplation, leading to action, and all that. I think we're always evangelizing if we're talking about truth and teaching. Is when I suspect, since you're wearing a tie on the radio, you probably wear one in your classroom. And I tell my students, because many professors don't wear ties, they say, well, we're about doing something sacred here. We're talking about the truth, and we just kind of dress accordingly as if it's important. And so normally I'll do my best to dress well,
right.
And for that reason alone, so we know that what we're doing is important and valuable. And in a way, though, every time we're talking like that, we are evangelizing if we're talking about true things. So I was glad to see that. Now, about 8 minutes left on the program here. So I do want to give you a chance to tell our listeners here on Faith and Reason a bit about what kind of work you're doing. On March 26th, you presented at the Catholic Studies Colloquium at Aquinas College. The colloquium is meant to do exactly that, to be a connecting place, to make Aquinas a connecting place for scholars of Catholicism and Catholic scholars in Michigan and in the general area. Mm-hmm. So we have a central locale for that. And we, of course, think that the Catholic College is a place to do that.
Amen.
And so we've had other participants come. And usually we have a professor from another college present a paper in a very academic format. One of our professors comment on it. Usually that's the case. And then for this, unlike the speaker series, which gets several hundred people, this year it may be 50, sometimes 100, just depends on who the presenter is. And it's a nice, more intimate gathering. And even though it's very academic, it's not too academic. That is, you know, anyone can come and I think learn something from this, from watching the scholarly interaction. So you presented a paper called Turning Worshippers into Gods, the Christian Understanding of Salvation. For the next few minutes, why don't you just tell us about that? That's your scholarly work that you're engaged in, besides this, can I call it an apostolate, or will that be a tenure killer? But besides this other great work you're doing at Hope, this is your research field, right? Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So I'm working on a topic called deification, and I'm doing it in the Latin fathers. So the early Christians who are speaking Latin in the first few centuries. So Tertullian, Cyprian, Augustine, Jerome, Ambrose, Benedict, Gregory the Great, people like that. And so I'm looking at this idea of deification, and that word deification means to be made into a god, right? Which to many people sounds very shocking, even heretical, or even very Mormon, right? Mormons believe that, not Catholics. But what I'm trying to say and what I'm trying to show is that this is actually a very central Catholic teaching, and it's the teaching of the undivided church in the beginning. So the church east and west both hold this idea of deification. So what is it, right? Well, the most famous formulation comes from St. Athanasius, who says, God became man so that man might become God. Right. So Christ, the second Son, the second person of the Trinity, emptied himself, became a human being so that he might share his divinity with us, right? And to bring us into his divine life. Right. And this is the teaching, this is the official teaching of the Catholic Church. It's actually the very first line of the first paragraph of the Catechism, that God in his infinite goodness freely created us in order for us to share in his own blessed life. Right. And so I'm trying to, again, make...
I mean, we hear that in the liturgy too, don't we?
We do, yeah.
About sharing in the divinity of Christ.
Yeah. Right, yeah, when the priest is mixing the water and the wine, right, that Christ humbled himself to share in our humanity so that we might come to share in his divinity. And it's just a very beautiful way of understanding salvation, that we're becoming more godlike, that God wants to share his being with us, that God is a communion, right? He's a Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. He's a family of love. He's a communion of persons, and he wants to bring us into communion with him. And he does this through the incarnation, and he does this through the sacraments. This is how he conveys his divine life to us.
Where do you go from here with your work on this? Is there a book planned? I mean, do you have a book in the works, or?
Yeah, so I'm at the very, very beginning of this project. I've written a few articles, and I have a few papers planned, including the one I gave at Aquinas.
But it's not, as of now, it's not part of a greater manuscript that's moving to press here.
No.
What is your book? Don't you have a book? Is it on Augustine?
I have a book on Augustine. It's called Creation in the Confessions, which very much deals with similar themes, but in the Confessions. So it starts with his understanding of creation, but for Augustine, his understanding of creation is very much ordered toward deification, toward our final destiny as being incorporated into God's divine life.
Okay. Well, it sounds like that emphasis that Catholics have had on the early fathers, Vatican II gave quite a renewal to that. It's my understanding. Correct me if I'm wrong. You're the religion professor. that for many years there was a Thomism and a Neo-Thomism, and some people were unhappy with the Neo-Thomism, and I think for some of the right reasons they were. And so that this is the only way we can talk about God, and so you have this rebirth particularly Ratzinger and others were a big part of, and starting to stress the early church fathers, but not in a very Protestant way of assuming that somehow the church is more correct and pure because it's earlier.
Right.
We do believe in development of doctrine as Catholics, and including development of practices. But on the other hand, there's so much there that maybe we hadn't mined in a long time, and that could supply a lot of answers to contemporary society, because we've never brought those fathers to bear on modern society yet, because we've just we've left them there, and we've only been bringing Thomas to bear on our questions for a couple hundred years. So it makes sense to me that if I was a Protestant Christian college and we were going to have one Catholic teacher of religion, we'd probably have him stress an era that we would have much more in common with than, say, in hiring somebody who only does you're a specialist on the 16th century Jesuits and how they reconverted large swaths of Europe. That makes a lot of sense, right? So that's excellent. Well, this is Dr. John Pinero. You've been listening to Faith and Reason. I want to thank you very much, Jared, for being on the program.
Thank you, John.
And you're welcome back anytime as things progress out at Hope with your St. Benedict Forum and Institute. Please keep us apprised. Come on, tell us about things. We'd be glad to have you on and encourage some of your fellow faculty members out there and participants. Maybe they have something they'd like to like to talk about the show here. I know I know a few of the folks out there hope they're doing very good things, Catholic professors and non-Catholics. So it's nice to see another vibrant Christian school in the area. This is Faith and Reason here on Holy Family Radio, 91.5 FM Kalamazoo, 1140 AM Grand Rapids. Thank you for listening. You can check out this show later on the web. All our shows are archived at holyfamilyradio.net. Just go to the Faith and Reason page. You can hear interviews there with people ranging from Jay Bujaszewski to Raymond Arroyo to Jared Ortiz to local folks, national figures. Eduardo Echevarria, you mentioned, had been on the show. That was probably my easiest show. One question and he's off, man, for 50 minutes. It's great. So check us out on Facebook, too, and please have a good afternoon.
You've been listening to Faith and Reason with your host, Dr. John Pinero, on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Dr. John Pinero is professor of history and director of Catholic studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Faith and Reason is brought to you by Holy Family Radio. I'm your program producer, Michael Fiorenzo. Join us next time as we connect the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition to daily life. Thanks for listening.